Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the 496th episode of the Hollywood Reporters Awards Chatter Podcast.
And the second one that we have had the pleasure of doing here in Cannes, for those of you who are tuning in as opposed to joining us here in the room, I will note that we are back in the Campari Lounge within the Palais at the Cannes Film Festival, the belly of the beast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, our executive editor of awards coverage at The Hollywood Reporter. It's great to be with all of you and great to be with one of our greatest actresses who I last had the opportunity to interview on this podcast in 2016 for our 34th episode. So there's been a lot of activity on our end and certainly on hers over the time since. Given how much she's been up to over the intervening years and that she is the star of one of the most anticipated films in competition here, this festival, Karim Enouz's Firebrand, in which she plays Catherine Parr, the sixth and final wife of King Henry VIII, I feel like we are due for another round, and so I'm thrilled that she agreed. At just 34, she is already an Academy Award, SAG Award, and Critics' Choice Award winner, a three-time BAFTA Award nominee, a two-time Golden Globe Award nominee for her performance on HBO's 2022 limited series Irma Vep. She is now in the running for an Emmy Award nomination, and I suspect that when people see Firebrand, this list of accolades is going to grow even further. Suffice it to say that she is, in the words of one fan, quote, the biggest Swedish export since IKEA, close quote. And so it is with great thanks to Megan Moss and Emma Jackson from her team, to Ryan Werner and Rachel Allen from Cinetic, from THR, Allison Smith-Pleiser, Curtis Thompson, Steven Wiesar, and Nicole Onofre, to everyone from Campari, and to our original producer of the podcast, Dara Takash, who's here with us. We thank all of you. And without further ado, would you please join me in welcoming Ms. Alicia Vikander.
Wow, I didn't get to have that kind of entrance last time.
That's true. We were in a little dark studio. This is better. So thanks for making the time. I guess just before we get into the whole story of your life and career and all of that, you've been at Cannes now, I think it's like this is 11 years since your first visit. Can you talk about the different occasions that have brought you here, including, I think, the last three in a row, or at least you've had work here last three in a row, and just what makes this place so special?
Yeah, the first time I was here with talking about Swedish Expo, but a documentary about Ingrid Bergman. Yeah. And being here, and, you know, this is a festival that I grew up, you know, looking up to, and I think I, you know, been following those images on that red carpet since I was a little child. So that was, you know, a huge moment. What was it, 12 years ago?
And I think you said your introduction to couture? Right?
Yes, I remember. I actually, that was even a year before that. I was here, they were selling A Royal Affair, a Danish film I was in. And then when I was here, they were like, do you want to walk the red carpet and go and watch one of the premieres? And I was like, yeah, but I mean, I don't have a dress, so I can't, sorry. And then they invited me up to one of those rooms, one of the couture brands, and I got to try on a dress, and, you know, I was absolutely stunned, and I remember I just took tons of photos. I probably thought that was my one and only time I was going to get to do that.
We should just note, since then, 2021 was Blue Bayou.
Blue Bayou.
2022 was Irma Vep. And now here we are with
First
Firebrand.
First time in official competition.
First time, yes.
Yeah, so it's a first.
You're ready for the fight this time, right?
No, I'm thrilled.
All right, so let's go back to the very beginning if we can. Just for the record, we've sort of talked about it in the intro, but where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was raised in Gothenburg, second biggest town in Sweden. My mother, Maria, my father, Svante. My mother was an actress and my dad is still a psychiatrist. So it's a great combo for this job.
So performing of one sort or another showed up in the picture very early. How much of that was just having been exposed to what your mother did and how much of it, because I think it was initially dance, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to say where it began. I mean, I think my love for music and dance and theater, those things, you know, has been my entire life. But I was growing up, my parents divorced when I was very young. So when I lived at my mother's house, you know, if she couldn't have a babysitter, I was always at the theater. So I was kind of living partly out of the wings. So I kind of grew up, you know, watching her, and I thought, you know, for a big part of my life, that was like kind of a normal thing,
yeah.
Just being around those actors and on that stage. But then I got in when I was 9 to the Royal Swedish Ballet School. And then obviously also because of the time, when you're there, you kind of dance like, you know, in the end, about 6 hours a day, at least 6 days a week. So it takes up a lot of your time.
And eventually, maybe not unexpectedly for many young people, I guess, in that situation, was there a bit of burnout? Did you want to try other things at a certain point?
Yeah, I mean, I think throughout my life, like, you know, when things are hard or tough, I just try to go back in my head to what it was like in ballet school, because I don't think it gets much tougher than that. And I mean, that's also why I still, when I, you know, I do know what they go through. And, you know, when I was shooting on my back, actually, I got the chance to go to the opera house and watch some ballet in Paris and, you know, seeing what they do. I mean, the woman who actually did Juliet, that night I watched Romeo and Juliet, I went and saw her backstage. She had a broken rib. And she was like thrown up in the air like about 80 times and like thrown on the floor. And she was like, no, I mean, it does hurt if I laugh. It's like, well, that's kind of, you know, that just shows. I mean, that's, and I guess at some point I was like, I don't know if I could live my life like that. No, I mean, but then I think actually the last year when I was in ballet school, you know, you kind of, you had to like do a kind of internal auditions to get whatever part for the last show. And I managed to get a really good part, you know, a ballet part. And I was very happy about that. But in the other, I was snuck in and went, I wanted to try and play the witch in Giselle, which is, you know, actually in history it was more men who did that part. And I was like, I want to give it a try. And then I got to go in and just mime. And then I got to do it. And I realized I prefer to do those shows more than doing the ballet, actually. And, you know, so that was maybe a little bit.
Well, so there was so you leave dance school at, what is it, like 18?
Yep.
And what goes on between then and the sort of role that first brought you to international attention, Pure? You were very close to going to become a lawyer, right?
I got into law school, like all my books, and it was like the first week when I was like about to start.
Yeah.
And then I was working in a like Levi's store, I remember, and I got a call. I remember I was in this, you know, cabinet with all these shoes, and someone called and you're like, you have an audition for like a leading role in a feature film. I remember, you know, that moment so well. And I was like, you know, I ran home after work and I started to read the scenes and quite quickly realized that, wow, it was not just any part. It was like one of those roles that are not given to young women very often. And it was a real challenge. And then Liz Langset, who was the writer and director, she took me in for like 4 or 5 auditions. I think.
Kept it going for
a
while. Yeah. I mean, up to that point, you had sort of, at least I guess within Sweden, become known for this soap opera, right? Second Avenue, is that, yeah?
Yeah.
And it was the first season,
It's like me, Noomi Rapace, and Rebecca Ferguson, like 3 Swedish actresses.
Okay, out of that.
We all have been in the only like 3 very large soap operas, one each in region.
Well represented. Well, So you have this whole drawn out process of getting the part in Pure, which we'll just say it's this Katarina, troubled young secretary who becomes obsessed with classical music while, you know.
Well, she becomes obsessed with classical music kind of away. She lives in the suburbs. She probably never have been introduced to it.
Yeah.
And because she becomes obsessed, she kind of pulls a few white lies to become a secretary to kind of get closer to the art that she's fallen so much in love with.
So you're just 19 when you get this part? And
I can't even remember. It's 19.
This is 2010 when it came out, but yeah, I think 19, yeah. Get the part. Was there any expectation that this movie could kind of find an international audience? We should know. You mentioned Noomi Rapace, and prior to her, I mean, really, there's Greta Garbo, there's Ingrid Bergman.
So I would say, Greta Garbo and Ingrid Bergman, that was kind of the reference I actually had, which meant I didn't have any thought of that. You know, that was just like a fantasy in a film for me. But when I was shooting Pure, and fun fact is, during that time, I remember I sat in the kitchen. She had just given me the part, Liz, and kind of invited me to her house to kind of like talk about the part. And then the Pure is based on her own play that was at the theater before that Noomi Rapace, where Noomi Rapace did the lead of my part.
So she was gone by that point.
So she knew, and she was like on the phone because she was like, you know, my actress and I know Noomi. She's like, she's going to go to Cannes with him. And that was my other, oh my God.
How does this happen? Yeah.
You know, that was like one of those, a Swedish actress that I know of is going to go to Cannes. And so that happened during that time. So that was kind of the first time I kind of knew that is it even possible nowadays?
Well, so again, this movie, well-received around the world. In the meantime, I guess you start hearing from people in the United States and abroad. I think you signed with UTA around that time. No, later?
It's better story.
Please, better, great.
No, but it's pretty crazy. I'd done my Swedish film. I was going back to law school. But then I actually got one more Swedish film. I was like, I'm going to give it, 2 years, see what happens, you know? Because I always thought you had
this
to go to
after
theater
Pure?
School. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then I go back and, like, I do, studying. But then I get the part in the Danish film. And in one way, that is my first international part. I'm going away
Royal
from Sweden.
Affair, yeah.
And I get to work with what, to me, was an international superstar, Mads Mikkelsen, already.
Yes, yes.
And then after that, you know, I probably, during this time, done like 20, 30 videotapes, you know, self-tapes for, like, you know, international shows or English-speaking things. And back then, I mean, this just, it's like, do you have a video camera? Plug it in, put on the modem, try and load it up for 7 hours. It didn't work. Being up at night, try again. I mean, it was like a couple of months full work that I spent doing that.
Right.
And I never heard anything back. I didn't get a no or a yes, clearly. But I kind of get sad. I was like, this doesn't work. I don't know why I'm doing this to my Swedish agent. I was like, I think I need to do like a... If I get into the room, at least, and get to, like, meet a casting director, and I think it will be maybe different, a human interaction. And then she's like, well, you know, they're going to try and find, like, a newcomer. They had just had Mia Wasikowska in Alice in Wonderland, and they were going to do Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yes.
And I was like... Sure. And I was like, so they do auditions in London. And I was like, I can save money and go to London. And she was like, yeah, I actually called the dance director. And they were like, no, it's just like girls with a bit more experience. You know, but you can send one of those self-tapes. Mm-hmm. But then she had said, and I didn't really understand the meaning of like a general meeting, which I do now.
Right.
But they were like, yes, if you're ever in London, the casting director said, you know, she'll be happy to meet you if you're there for a general meeting. And I was like, general meeting, great. And then... 3 days later, I called my Swedish agent. So I was like, yeah, I'm in London. She's like, what? She's like, no, I'm here like for a friend's concert. And she's like, okay. So I was like, if, you know, I could have a general meeting if she wants to have one.
And did you?
Cut to the last day. She calls me in the morning. She just called me. She's seen Pure overnight, your Swedish film. And she said, if you're here before 11, you get to do the casting.
For Snow White and the Huntsman.
So I got on a bus. Like, I got there. I remember she looked at me. She was like, do you have, like, a lipstick? Or, like, you know, something, I had to do your hair, and I don't know, Swedish, you know, the culture. I was like, no, no. She kind of like helped me look a bit more presentable and, you know, helped me with my lines. But then we did the thing, and then I went back.
Yep.
And then the other day I was at Oxford Circus. I was at Starbucks waiting for my bus to Stansted Express to take you back to the Ryanair flight. And I get a call, and that is like one of those film moments. So I get a full call, and they say, so they just called and they're bringing in for a screen test. No clue what a screen test was.
Right.
I was like, that sounds great, you know, and they're going to fly you to LA.
To LA.
And I've never been to LA. I've never been since, like, and I break down. I was like crying so much. Like people, one guy came up to me and thought like I had a boyfriend who broke up with me on the bus. I'm just so happy. So, you know, that journey out to Sansa Express, is a big memory. And that was when I went, I didn't get the part clearly, but within those 24 hours, apparently, like, you know, LA knew that I had been there. They said, I didn't know what that meant, but then I had like tons of agents that wanted to sign me, and they actually all came here, so I got to interview them. It was wild.
So at that point, then you...
My Swedish, and then actually in Herod and Charles, I just met British representation, and they kind of tell them, I mean, I wouldn't have... They were like, well, if you want to sign her, she'll be in Cannes, so you can come here. So they flew in.
Quick turnaround from nobody caring.
It was absolutely wild.
So... Meanwhile, A Royal Affair comes out at about the same time that Snow White and the Huntsman did. And it worked out fine because this is a movie that first time you're playing a queen, right?
No. In Royal Affair.
So you're playing, this is 18th century Denmark's Queen Caroline Mathilde, gets involved with the court physician, played by Mads Mikkelsen, while King Christian descends into mental illness. This is the thing that the filmmaker Nicolas Arcel said was that he saw something quote unquote regal about you. And I actually was thinking about it might come back to the dance, right? I mean, there's a sort of poise that comes with that, maybe.
I think it might have, you know, yeah maybe I can like walk straight
up. Good posture, yeah. But that, you know, this is a movie that goes on to be an Oscar-nominated film. It won the Berlinale. You get nominated for the BAFTA Rising Star Award. It really, again, it's if there's big steps along the way, this was maybe the next big one. And I just wonder, you know, anything specifically for you that stands out when you think back to that film?
Well, that was even bigger. I mean, Nikolai took such a huge chance in me, or trusted me and gave me this chance. I mean, as you know, there's not a lot of films being like made in Scandinavia, obviously, because the countries are, you know, smaller. So when I look back, that I had those like three first films that I made in, you know, Scandinavia, you know, and they were, you know, incredible films and roles. All of them is like, you know, of course, made the biggest difference for my career. But I mean, Nikolai, it's amazing because, I mean, the same thing. Actually, the first time I went into audition, when I was sent the script, I called the concert. I was like, but it's in Danish.
Right.
And she was like, yep. And I was like, but I'm not Danish. I was like, so I had like my friend's like mom, who's half Danish, half Swedish, who like recorded the lines. And I mean, I didn't know this. Cut to like now, I think by the end of the film, Nikolai was like, "Is that you, Danish actor?" Good, no, we should reshoot the film now. And I was like, "Don't say that with all the work I put in."
You literally learned Danish weeks.
I was there for 3 months before we started
shoot.
I mean, it's not like the language are clearly, you know, related a lot, you know. But when I started, I mean, the thing is, when I came to Denmark for the last screen test with Mass. That night, same thing, I saw Nikolai, and then he said something, and I was like, I've done so much of this smiling and nodding and trying to understand, and my brain is like fried. And he said something, and I was like, I'm just going to go with it. And I'm just like, you know, and he's like, said it again. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, in English, I just gave you the password. And I was so happy. And I was like, by that point, I was like, oh my God, he's already regretted it. How is this woman even going to try and speak Danish? You know, so that goes to how much, you know,
what an
a
ordeal.
Lot to thank for Nick Wilson.
Now, that same year, 2012, as a result, again, of Pure, you are in your first English language film, Anna Karenina, your Kitty, the flirtatious young woman who believes that, she's entranced by the Aaron Taylor Johnson character, the Count, only to find love with the Donald Gleason character. This is Joe Wright's movie, very kind of expressionistic one. Keira Knightley, all these people around you.
Jude Law
for the first time. Yeah. So 11 years ago.
We played Royals back then,
too. So I guess I wonder the circumstances under which that movie, which it's really unusual, just the whole way he approached the, you know, I think with almost like a proscenium, if I remember at the beginning and all that. But the shoot itself was pretty grueling, wasn't it? Or at least a portion of it.
I mean, it was pretty interesting because when I first got the part, Jeriah had planned on doing a much more like traditional shoot. He was talking about, you know, we were going to go to Russia, shoot it there. And then I don't know if it was location, whatever reasons it was, I think he just felt like he couldn't do the vision that he had first like imagined. And then he was like, I'm just going to, which I think is extremely impressive. He was like, well, then I'm going to do my own thing. And he's like, I'm going to set it all in this one stage. And CeeLo Labi, which is an incredible choreographer, I was probably one of the few people actually like, oh my God, knew it was, you know, like, wow.
Right.
You know, I got to work with these people that I don't think I would have been able to work with if I actually had been dancer still. And so, I mean, it was a lot of preparation, but I mean, it's like the beginning of the film, I actually saw, you know, it was a person next to me on a flight not too long ago, a few years, who looked and saw it. And it's almost like when now a few years later, because I would say I kind of never go back and watch films that I've been in. Because of that, I saw the first scene. And I think he's done an incredible job. It's like a one take. And I don't know, we spend a few days and then weeks obviously rehearsing that thing. And, you know, I think he really pushed boundaries of what you can do.
So from there, that's your big 2012. You go in 2013, The Fifth Estate for Bill Condon, about the whole Julian Assange situation. We've got 2014, Testament of Youth, Vera Brittain. And then 2015 is like a year, I think the only person who there's ever been anything like this in my memory was Jessica Chastain's 2011, I think, when she had like, you know, seven movies or something crazy that were all out at the same time. Obviously not all made at the same time, same with you, but here I think in different parts of the world, they were released different times. But in the U.S., I think it might have been five or six at the same time. So let's just kind of, we're not going to go into all of them. But the two that really, I think, popped in a major way. First one comes out in April in theaters. That is Ex Machina. This is you playing Ava, an android, for Alex Garland, who had never directed a film before. He's written the script, which you've said when you read it was the best thing you'd ever read up to that point. What made it that?
Because it's so concise. There's everything that needs to be there is there and nothing else. And that's kind of rare. You know, it's great dialogue, a lot of like not much stage directions or explanations. It was kind of a lot of it you had to read, you know, or understand by reading the actual scenes and what happens in the scenes emotionally. It was, you know, just creating Eva. That was actually a self-tape I made from Perth in Australia. I remember I was shooting a film there and I'd, you know, read the script and I was like, it was one of those parts. I was like, I want this so, so, so bad. And I had that help. I told like a few, it was like so nice. It was like an assistant of the camera guy that I became friends with there and like another actor. And like, you know, it's that kind of thing. They were like, we'll help you. So I was like, really? And they came off like 11 p.m. We were sitting in this like little apartment and we tried to light it. And I was like, you know, trying to figure out, because there was no real description of what Ava looked like more than that she was an incredible machine. And then, so I was there, made it a really tight bun. I really like lit it from the top on this kind of like reflective table. And then I put like a whole like bottle of sunscreen and like did it all on my head. I was just like glossy.
an edge.
But I was like, and it kind of is like funny when I see the final version, it's still something in there, you know? So I was able to start creating a character and then, you know, Garland.
Do you think the dance came in useful for that one as well, the dance
background? Yeah, totally. I mean, that was one of the big things about me wanting to create this character, was trying to figure out, I mean, I was at home, like, trying to figure out how she walked and talks. And one of the things that I really realized was when it's a bit like when people say, oh, you play drunk, you should just try to not play,
right,
you know? And that was kind of the same with this Ava character. It was almost like, no, I tried to make a human 2.0. And when I kind of did her too good, like the human was too good at things, right, then it becomes a bit just jarring.
The big question, I guess, for viewers, and I imagine for anyone working on this film, does Ava possess consciousness? Now, did you answer that for yourself? And then did you discuss that with Alex? Because the whole thing looks very different depending on how one comes down on that question, right?
Yeah, we did discuss it a lot, and I thought about it all the time.
Yeah.
Even more when I was doing it.
Did you have an answer for yourself?
No, I mean, I think in one way we live in a world where that question is, you know, even more prominent right now.
Yeah, right.
So, but it was very interesting, and I think it morphed and took turns. I think it changed a lot, for me, but it was very interesting when I started to do press and interviews, because it was people who came in and who were like really like upset, but for different reasons. One was super upset that they had put this like young girl in a box and locked her in, and one other was like, oh my god, that, you know, she's out there in the world now. What is she gonna do, you know?
Right So now the other big one, of course, from that year is The Danish Girl, but that one obviously deals with trans issues, which we're gonna talk about that film and what it brought up. But I found it interesting that you said there were plenty of people who also approached you with sort of the trans related topics for Ex Machina, right? Just being out of your body in a way, or not feeling like, what was that about?
I'm trying to remember when I...
Well, I think you were saying that there were people who said, you know, if the trans people that said they kind of connected to Ava, who may not be in the body that she felt.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, her search of identity and finding the true, you know, self and her outer shell and figure out what that is.
Yeah. And so then with The Danish Girl, this is, again, Ex Machina comes out in April. In November, following a lot of film festivals and anticipation, in November, Danish Girl comes out. You joining Eddie Redmayne and Tom Hooper, who had already worked together at least once, maybe even more than that prior to that, right? But just Gerda, the wife of Lily, one of the first people to receive gender reassignment surgery. Eddie, I think, has kind of spilled the beans, because I don't think he thought that you would, that about how Tom reacted to your audition or reading or whatever it was where he first saw you perform a scene from that. Can you share what happened there?
No, I think he said it was, it just, like it does sometimes when you do those things. I mean, I've been practicing at home, and it's like on the page, and it's like leading up when you're shooting, you're like, this needs to work. This scene is the kind of, you know, the peak. This is emotionally where you need to get to. And then, of course, going in on a, like, you know, screen test is very nerve-wracking. And, you know, Eddie obviously had the part. I was nervous just meeting him and Tom. But then, you know, when a scene like that is well-written and you
go for
it...
What was the scene that you were asked to do?
It's the scene when she kind of comes home and she kind of asks, you know, I need you to support me now, you know. And and when we made that scene, you know, that magic that happens normally when you actually on set, but got emotional. And then I think, you know, it can happen to other people in the room at the same time.
Such as Tom.
He's a very sensitive guy.
Yeah. Well, obviously it was a amazing performance, but it could have gone away altogether, because after being offered the part in that, you're then offered the part in the light between oceans.
Yeah, they were going to go at the same time for some time. Yeah.
So let's just think about for a second. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you had not done Light Between Oceans then, and they had, you would not have met Michael Fassbender,
I'd met him on some dance floor.
Somewhere else, right? And if you had not done The Danish Girl, Oscar might have had to wait a little while longer, right? A lot of other things. So just the fact was that The Danish Girl people were willing to wait, was it like 7 months or something, so you could go and do...
Was it that long? I don't know. No, yeah.
Okay. A few months?
Yeah, a few months.
And then you come back and the film comes out at a time when, you know, I think really for the first time in American society, people were really talking in large numbers about trans issues. This was right when Transparent was on Amazon. It's when Caitlyn Jenner was coming out and all of this. And then this film enters the conversation. Can you talk about just the sort of impact that it had from being in the eye of the storm? What was that like for you?
I mean, it's incredible to see where we're at now, comparison to when Danish Girl come out. And it's one of those things where, I mean, in a good way, everyone's eyes have like opened up, and like myself, my journey, you know, especially making The Danish Girl was, you know, huge, because I got to, you know, personally meet and become friends and get help from so many people who wanted to help us and support us from the trans community. But it's one of those things, I mean, obviously with the conversations that are now, that film would probably not have been made in that way now.
And it's only but not it's, even...
It, but, it, you know, but it was one of those first steps. So in that sense, I feel like it was, you know, an important one for the conversation to be in.
Now, just a humorous side note, I think you're the only actual Scandinavian in The Danish Girl.
Yeah, and he was so like, you know, Tom was like, what are we going to do? I was like, what? He's like, yeah, are you willing to like go blonde? You know, he was like, you do not look very Scandinavian. And I was like, well, I mean, shouldn't say it. I'm like the only Scandinavian person in this room. But yeah, and then I did.
And what did they just like, they like put makeup or something to like, what was it? Because you're...
Yeah, they did actually. Yeah. I don't know if we could do that right now.
Anyway. Okay, so that film premieres at Venice, then Telluride, then Toronto, and suddenly the whole world is talking about, who is this newcomer, Alicia Vikander? How did you handle, over those months leading up to the Oscars, this sudden, massive increased level of attention, and also the promotional obligations that come with that, everything that then culminates on Oscar night? How did you acclimate to that?
I actually think, you know, the kind of the press commitments and doing those things, in the end, I don't think that was kind of, you were kind of on a, it's almost like you didn't reflect over it at all when it was happening, because it was like this train that came, and it was obviously like something that was beyond anything I would ever have dreamed of. So you stand there and you're like, you're kind of overwhelmed constantly, you know, and extremely like happy and fortunate what you get to experience and the rooms you're in, the people you get to meet, people are like, you know, and it was, and I think that I kind of loved. And then obviously it's like, it was more the kind of, you have your own idea of yourself. And then suddenly when you've never been in a public space, it's like seeing yourself from an outside perspective for the first time. You've never really like done that.
You're talking about the way people are writing about you and...
Yeah, and even like watching yourself, hearing yourself, it's kind of like getting to know. It's not saying that it's not you, but it's kind of like you get to like figure out whilst it's happening, and it's happening in a very large way, what the kind of this version of this persona is.
Could you enjoy it, or did it suck the fun out of it?
I've talked about it. I think it was something I realized after it happened. I think when I was in it, you know, it was like, I was really trying my best to like being, you know, cause it was the biggest thing I've ever been through. You know, it's like, I can't deny that. But then at a certain point afterwards, it's almost like you've been through this huge thing. And then, you know, I think, yeah, it's, you're afraid. It's almost like you're afraid of not being as happy as you should be all the time, because it is the most incredible thing that has happened. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think,
and it
you
was
know,
a bit lonely, right? You've said.
Yeah, I think, you know, being, that's one of the things that was actually so, like, other actresses, older actresses that, you know, I looked up to, and they were kind of checking in a nice way. You're like, oh, I'm good, I'm good, you know. But it's that thing, because you kind of realize, not again, not so much you, but then it's like my girlfriends and my friends back home, and almost all my friends are not in the industry.
Yeah.
So they kind of became even better at kind of seeing things. So they were like, hey, like, you haven't been seeing, and you haven't, like, literally been on a flight for 2 years.
Yeah.
And never, like, seen you've been home, yeah. You know.
It's a lot. Just to put a cap around that topic, Oscar night, it's you and your mother. Can you, what will you remember most about Oscar night? Just with being there and with her and all of that.
Yeah, well, my mother passed a few months ago.
I'm sorry.
So.
Very sorry.
So, of course, that was, you know, I've been, over the past few months, I've had tons of, like, family and friends who've been, you know, sending a lot, sharing a lot of photos, a lot of love.
Yeah.
And we just had the memorial. And, like, one of the most, like, shared photos I realized is a photo that I think someone about, you know, it was my dad or someone, took of my mom and me that night. And my mom looks like fucking like a million.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse.
No, you please.
I can say that.
Say whatever you want.
I'm allowed.
Yeah.
You know, so now that night has even greater, you know, it's, I got to be there
and
with
she,
her.
And
she introduced me to this and she got to see that.
Yeah, it's great. After the craziness maybe a little bit calmed down, or maybe this even might have started in the middle of the craziness, you become part for the first time of something totally unlike, of a scale unlike anything you've done before, which is Jason Bourne, the first, you know, the big reunion of Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon, big summer action movie, giant studio production. Nothing that, I mean, you've done a lot of great work, but not on that kind of a scale before. Was what drew you to it just getting to get a taste of that, or, you
no,
know?
No, because I was a huge Jason Bourne.
You were? Okay,
fan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was like the first thing I said to Paul when I met him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so,
did it live up to your expectations of what it's like?
No, it was like, I mean, it was, I mean, it's kind of funny when you're going to work and you're like the fan.
You're right.
So it takes a few days for you to like calm down, but yeah.
Is it harder to kind of control your performance or do the things that had gotten you to that point? You've done so well on more intimate projects. Is it harder to kind of control that when there's so much going on around you?
Yes and no. I think it's more that thing of getting to, you know, you get to a set and you see the scale of it. But actually, when it comes down to the work that actors and the director does,
yeah,
it's more that you realize, oh, actually, that's the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, just to provide the contrast, that same year, even though it had been shot just before The Danish Girl, out comes Late Between Oceans. You, Michael, for Derek St. France, who works about as polar opposite from a studio kind of way as anyone, can you talk about, I mean, this is the guy who had done Blue Valentine, and I think at that point also already The Place Beyond
Place
the
Beyond
Pines. And here you're playing this woman who, with a World War I veteran, played by Michael, trying to have a child of their own. They end up taking in a child that maybe they shouldn't have. But the point is, working in, can you describe the way that working with Derek works?
Yeah, he's like a method director. I mean,
yeah.
He's very much like, I mean, and I think actually both Michael and I, we realized we're not method actors, but it was like we were willing to, you know, try whatever he wanted. And he wanted, you know, to build these full 360 sets, but not in a studio, in, you know, out in the real world, this house where they lived, like even the canned food that was like, you know, proper period. Well, actually, you could open and eat them, you know. And it was a bit tough, I think, for the crew sometimes, in the sense that they were like not allowed on set in the house. But then we kind of, improvised our ways into scenes and made the scene and then somehow finished it off with some sort of tale, and he just kept going. And he never said action or cut, which made you sometimes just realize that you were probably in the scene already. And you're like, realized by looking at everyone else. That's actually one of the things I love the most. I think now the more and more I realize with each film that I'm making, I'm very much like, I'm kind of game in the sense that, every actor, I do have my own way of preparing myself when I'm at home, and you know, but I've become more and more, I think in the beginning of my career, more like, this is who I am, this is how I work. And I've become more and more like, when I meet a director, they were like, well, I do it like this. I was like, sure. Because it kind of gives you a new experience of a few months and kind of maybe just helps you to actually break away and do something new, because you don't feel like it's in the same routine that you made things before.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I really, you know, really, I absolutely loved working with Derek.
How, and just the idea at that point, I don't think you or Michael knew each other before that, to work, he had already established himself at that point. You had not yet gotten the recognition that came with Danish Girl and all of that. How did you find working with each other?
No, I mean, it was great. We had actually met on his industry, like we met on two dance floors before.
Really?
Yeah, actually the first time Derek, like, you know, met, he was like, do you know Michael? And I was like, well, only like physically, we've only been dancing. And we've never spoken, right? Maybe it was like 2 hour sessions on two dance floors.
Yeah.
So in that sense, we had a feel of one another. But then we showed up at rehearsals in New Zealand. And obviously, I mean, he's my husband, best friend now.
Right.
But I also consider him one of the best actors of his generation.
No question, yeah.
And, you know, so going in there, I just knew I just want to, you know, get up there, and I'm gonna try my very best to
go toe-to-toe,
you know,
yeah,
to
yeah.
go toe-to-toe.
Yeah.
Totally.
So one of the, I guess, very interesting and in a way sad things you said about the next movie, Tulip Fever, 2017. This is a Tom Stoppard script, Justin Chadwick making it. You're playing this woman, the orphan wife of a wealthy merchant. It's sort of a love triangle. But what had you never experienced that you experienced for the first time on Tulip Fever?
Working with Harvey Weinstein.
Well, no, I wouldn't. That too. That isn't even where I was going. But yeah, he did take a producing credit. Yeah, that I'm sure was not one of the more memorable parts of that. But no, but I mean, not too many of your prior movies had dialogue between women, right?
No, that was actually, that was a huge thing. I remember just saying when we were on set, we were... you know, I kind of came out and I was just like, that was fun day, you know, and it was kind of whack when Honey and I just looked at each other and realized, and I've said it before, but I had done like 5 films back to back leading up to that film where I was the lead, and I didn't have one scene with another woman. It wasn't like Lady Two or something.
Or the trans character, but yes,
yes,
that's kind of crazy. And you feel like things actually since then have slightly gotten better in that regard, or maybe is it still a problem, big problem?
No, it has changed.
Okay.
I mean, it is wonderful in the sense that, I mean, thinking back, especially when I like have memories of shooting like my first films like 12, 30 years ago, to now see women not only included in the scripts that I'm reading, but like now they're like gaffers, they're riggers, the camera crews. You know, it's just now, you know, for the next film I'm doing, and I looked and I was like, it's 5 only female producers, you know, and it's like things that I hadn't seen just a few years back.
And no more Harvey Weinstein. So there's just another legacy of that one. But go back to another giant one with Tomb Raider. This is the reboot, of course, of the Angelina Jolie, Lara Croft part. Just should we assume that that was because it was, you know, I guess in this case, probably the most physically demanding thing you'd ever done in a film, right? I mean,
For sure.
Was that the appeal, or what made you go for that?
I mean, the other day, I was super excited about the new Indiana Jones film. You know, I grew up with those films.
Yeah.
I love especially like the matinee kind of adventure films were some of my favorite, alongside like Star Wars and sci-fis. And so, and I was a girl who I did like, I remember when I was first introduced, friends, like dad had a computer. I was like really kind of interested in those things, you know, and he had a game, and I remember I was there and I got to play it.
You
and my
girlfriend
was like so annoyed because I really didn't like want to leave this thing. And then after that, that was like something that I kind of hid. You know, it was like I didn't tell girlfriends because they didn't really seem to enjoy it as much as I did. But right. I really like computer games.
Yeah.
So I had played Lara Croft when, you know, the first games, even though I was terrified of the bear and like stuff. But, but, you know, so then to even like suddenly be in a conversation again with someone was like, why can't I make a reboot? I was like, that was super just cool.
Yeah, sure. 2020, you're young Gloria Steinem in Julie Taymor's The Glorias. 2021, we mentioned Blue Bayou, the nurse married to a man facing deportation. We also get to hear you sing the Linda Ronstadt song.
My God.
I didn't know that you, did you always sing? Or?
I will tell you, I mean, so I had seen Justin's Goop, like his first film. So I did a brilliant job and met him, thing is such a, you know, interesting filmmaker. I read the script and I was like, also, I got to play a part there. Talking about like at the beginning of my career, I was kind of get to play these royals.
Yeah,
and for a long time, they were like, well, she's kind of British and she's kind of like, you know, from a very like nice background. And it was actually quite far away from, you know, the reality. And one way to tell much more, you know, like a blue collar, like, you know, middle class, like real human story was something that I think I wanted to for a long time, but no one really saw me in that space.
Posture's too good. You got to work.
No, but then I got to do it. And, but then of course I called him up and I was like, but what about, I was like, I've been, you know, cause I, Lena Ronstadt's incredible, but I was like, that's a tricky song.
Yeah.
It's like, I was like, have you tried to sing yourself? and then I was like, maybe I can do another song. He was like, the script is called Blue Bayou. I was like, yeah. And then we came to the day and, you know, it is such an incredible, powerful song. But it was one of those moments, it was sweet because it happened at some point, maybe in like on my first film, maybe it's when I did my Danish film, when I found myself, and this was like 2 a.m., we were in this Vietnamese like little band that were going to play with me, and about 60 extras. And I go up on stage just to like, you know, light, you know, prepping for the scene. And then I look down and I'm shaking. Like, I'm actually like so nervous. And I was like thinking, I was like, wow, I have, this has not happened in like over 10 years, I think. And I said, so, okay, listen, now you're going to do something. You're actually going to do something that you're like terrified of doing. But then I did it. And I really, that's like my, probably my favorite scene in the end. And
you
maybe
have a
because,
very nice
because
voice.
Of that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, even your speaking voice, I think, is cool. But anyway. all right. This brings us. Well, first, actually, like, we can't gloss over 2021, The Green Knight, David Lowery. A lot of people really love that. Very unusual film. You and Dev Patel. 2022, again, Irma Vep brought you here. I think your first time really doing television since the soap opera days with Olivier Assayas. Very like meta in every way. He's remaking his own thing, which is about an
actress.
Yeah, it's hard to, let me see the way it's described. An American movie star who is disillusioned by her career and recent breakup comes to France to star in a remake of a French silent era classic. I mean, it's a lot to keep track of, but you did get to show maybe more of a comedic side of yourself than you'd had.
Kind of a lighter side.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and I think that's something I've really, I mean, I'm longing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was one of those kind of conversations that you know, because I've known Olivia for a few years, so we've been meeting up when I'm in Paris sometimes, and it was nice because we were both kind of in that place. He said, I just want to do something for. I was like, yes. I was like, me too.
Right,
and I was
right.
So it was kind of, it was a wonderful thing to get to kind of let go a bit more.
And then here we are with this sort of full circle.
Very different.
Moment that we're back here with Firebrand. You are back as a queen and not just any queen. This is Catherine Parr, the sixth and final wife of Henry VIII, played by Jude Law in Cream Anuzes, is that the proper pronunciation?
Anush
is Firebrand, his first English language film that he's directing, based on Elizabeth Fremantle's 2013 novel, Queen's Gambit. The movie title has changed for obvious reasons. Thanks a lot, Anya Taylor-Joy.
It's a good title,
Firebrand. It's a good title.
Yeah.
and, you know, I guess the rhyme or whatever about Henry VIII, where they go through the wives, right? Divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So what can you tell us about, as far as what did you know going into this about Catherine, and what made you want to play her?
I mean, one of the first things that I realized myself was, you know, I think I'm like a lot of, you know, I lived in the UK for about 7 years. So that was my base. And I guess, you know, compared to a lot of my British friends, I didn't grow up in school reading as much about that history. But throughout the past few years, I mean, the Tudors have been like, you've been fed that story, you know, a lot on TV and film. So, but then I was like, well, I almost felt embarrassed. I was like, I probably know the least about Catherine Parr out of all of them. And then I realized that that is definitely the general around. And it's interesting. And that's kind of just because she was the only one who didn't die,
right.
I think. You know, which is, it just shows.
Prematurely.
It's like human nature, where people are kind of, you know, leading towards what kind of stories. And then, you know, immediately then when I actually read up about this woman and realize that she's like, yeah. And the fact that no one really cared about the fact that she was like the first woman in British history who published books under her own name. I was like, that's quite a big thing in history
and
I'd never heard.
Knowing what had happened to her predecessors was still kind of activist, well, ballsy, even kind of under the nose of her husband, in terms of...
Oh, she had to learn how to manage this relationship. And that was also what interested me when I read the script, that, you know, it's in a kind of a pulling... We you know, because of the play, we made an artistic decision, the writers to you know, set this, that the court is now left to a smaller castle, which makes the story a bit more intimate. And when the whole story is kind of set within those rooms. And, you know, it's really a kind of them become more, you know, about this relationship drama and about, well, domestic abuse. And also about then the kind of, you know, managing this danger and person next to you all the time and having to do things that you don't agree with, but you know, to kind of move forward, to survive even, you have to be very delicate and very clever. And I thought, you know, the kind of portrayal of this woman and her closest women. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, because we did a lot of research. We had like these incredible people who came and were like Tudor experts. They like lived like in the Tudor times for like 6 months once in a while. I mean, pretty incredible people. But just to know that there were like 300 men normally staying at the castle all the time and like 8 to 12 women. I was like, just that image of these, like this little group of women.
Right.
And this
got to stick together, yeah.
Man.
So you mentioned the abusive relationship there in the movie. That is made very real and creepily so by Jude Law, who is almost unrecognizable and fantastic in this. I mean, just some of the stuff which I imagine might be truly true to the historical record, but like referring to himself always in the plural, like we think that, you know, just so many things there are creepy as hell. You had again worked with him 11 years earlier. Was that helpful? Was it, how did you and he decide to tackle this?
I mean, in Anachronina, we didn't have any scenes at all, but it was one of those things where, I mean, talking about that other previous time when I probably had been shaking was my first English speaking film.
Right.
And working with like Keira Knightley and Jude Law and like, and he was, and Keira, they both were so like sweet to everyone, especially like me who came new. And, you know, that really like, maybe it's something he didn't think of, but when you're a young actor, it means so much. And I could see how he, you know, managed like the entire crew. He's like the nicest person and he's an incredibly hard working actor. And so I just, when I heard that he was attached to do it, because he was before the film came to me, I with like films I've seen him do over the past few years and interesting roles he's taken, I just knew he was going to do an incredible job. And when I then came on, he had already, you know, been in talks kind of, they were, you know, trying to find finance for a long time. And he had been like, you know, knowing Kareem then for quite a while. And then to kind of backtrack, the preparation he'd done was pretty incredible. I mean, I had like a few weeks to like catch up, but I almost also, again, I felt like I wanted to try and like get to a point where I really get to match him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he, when the day he stepped out on set, that was a fully formed like character. And I mean, he's doing like one song, one of his real like songs in the film.
Yeah.
And does the piano all himself. I mean, that was one. He could do the whole repertoire. He could just continue and do the new song for each scene. That's not in the film.
It's very, very creepy performance. It's like, to me, it's up there with like Hannibal Lecter or something. Great job by both of you. And I wonder, you know, the world premiere is tomorrow night here, 7:30, right behind us at the Palais. The film is up for U.S. acquisition still. In a moment like this, when you're about to share a passion project with the world, is that, do you feel excitement, nerves? What's this moment like for you?
I can't, you know, like I said, it's my first time in my career. I've never been
in competition.
So obviously, I'm like thrilled. You know, that is really like a huge thing to be part of. And you know, when you do have a film that you, you know, really loved making, and just meeting Jude today, I think Kareem last night, it's, you know, it's that thing, you're getting back with the gang.
Yeah.
And I think we're all like, we couldn't think of a better home, a better place to release this film to the world.
Totally. So last question is just, you know, here we are, again, approximately a decade ago, you were here for the first time, just thrilled to have a couture dress to wear. A lot has happened in those intervening years. When you think back about just how much has happened in a relatively short amount of time, how do you process that? And also, are there specific things that are, you know, still on the to-do list? If we sit down here in another, you know, 10, 11 years or whatever, you hope you will have gotten the chance to do. I think I'd heard you talk about directing once, just different things. So rather than me answering it for you, please, what's state of the union and hopes for the future?
To kind of be, you know, I've been loving being part of projects from earlier stages, and yeah, I hate to kind of put it out, but it's nice. I should put it out into the world more. I think, you know, creating films is something that I realize is actually what I love making, and obviously acting in them is a part of it, but there's so much more to it that I think I would love to kind of try at some point. Yeah, that's probably like a big one, a scary one.
Well, I have no doubt you will do it soon and well, and thank you so much for coming and doing this. Really appreciate it. Alicia McAdder.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.